As you all know, there's two parts to the ordination ceremony in the Triratna Buddhist order. There's the private ordination ceremony, and then a bit after that, there's the public ordination ceremony. And towards the end of the public ordination ceremony, four very important verses are recited after your public preceptor. And these verses represent the spirit with which ordination is given, and the spirit with which you receive the ordination. And the verses go like this: with loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. In harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. For the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. So this is a very important set of verses, and we need to contemplate them deeply, because they do really represent, if you like, the values of our order. First of all, it's important that we have loyalty to our teachers, to our preceptors, and of course to Sangharakshita, who is our, if you like, our original teacher, our founder. And we practice the Dharma, and we go for refuge following the teachings that he's given us, and in accordance with the spirit with which he's given those teachings. And then there is harmony. Being an order member means working to create and deepen harmony with others in the Sangha, the widening Sangha, because the Sangha isn't a fixed thing. The order isn't a fixed thing. There's always this opening out to new people joining the order. So there needs to be this commitment at ordination to developing harmony. And then, of course, we're ordained in order to attain enlightenment itself, to attain Bodhi. That's our aim, our ultimate goal. We might feel that enlightenment is very distant, and that it's so profound, so subtle, and so difficult to see. And if you have those feelings, that's very appropriate. But nonetheless, we commit ourselves to attaining enlightenment, to moving in the direction of enlightenment, to taking our inspiration from the ideal of enlightenment, and so that we're living for enlightenment in all that we do. And finally, we're ordained not only for our own human and spiritual development, we are ordained to benefit all living beings. We're ordained, we accept ordination in order to benefit all living beings, to help them in their human and spiritual development. We go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha for the benefit of everyone. We go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha so that we can benefit everyone that we meet, so that who we interact with. We go for refuge in order to benefit, to contribute to all that is good in life, in order to bring about the general movement towards the good, capital G. Ultimately, we go for refuge so that all living beings may be liberated from suffering, from restriction, from limitation. So this way of speaking brings to mind especially the Bodhisattva ideal, which is, of course, the theme of this retreat, because the Bodhisattva is the being, according to well, not just Mahayana, but actually general Buddhist tradition. The Bodhisattva is the being fully committed to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. The Bodhisattva is not interested in gaining enlightenment for himself alone. He doesn't believe that there is such a thing as enlightenment, as spiritual development for oneself alone. The Bodhisattva regards the notion of enlightenment for oneself, is actually impossible, because enlightenment is not just about wisdom, it's not just about seeing things as they are, it's not just about being liberated from greed, hatred and delusion. Quintessential to enlightenment is love, is maitri, metta, and karuna, compassion. Love and compassion for those who suffer. The Bodhisattva wants to alleviate suffering on all levels, but especially he wants to alleviate the deep and subtle suffering that is caused by spiritual ignorance. The deep and subtle suffering that comes from not living from what is deepest in us. Not living, if you like, from our deep humanity, our true humanity, if you like. Now, when we talk about the Bodhisattva ideal, people bring to mind very quickly, if they know a bit about Buddhism, Hinayana and Mahayana and all that sort of sectarian language and so on. But really, the Bodhisattva ideal is the Buddhist ideal. And it's found in the earliest Buddhist texts. It isn't just found in Mahayana literature. It's found in the Pali Canon itself. Before his enlightenment, the Buddha is called the Bodhisattva, which is the Pali for Bodhisattva. Because it's clear from the beginning of his quest for enlightenment, I'm not just talking about the Jatakas here, where he's the Bodhisattva, but even in his, as it were, his final birth, when he became enlightened, he's called the Bodhisattva. And it's clear from the beginning of his quest that the Buddha, Gotama, as we should call him, is concerned with others. He's not just concerned with his own liberation. There's a text in the Pali Canon describing him in his palace when he was a young man, a young prince, and it shows him reflecting deeply on illness, old age, and death. He reflected that when people, an uninstructed ordinary person, as he calls him, when an uninstructed ordinary person sees illness in another, old age in another, when they see death in another, they feel aversion, they feel fear, they even feel disgust. They want to avoid those suffering people. And people do this, Gotama reflected, the Bodhisattva reflected, because they do not realise, they don't see, they've not fully accepted that they will become, they will grow old, they will become ill, and they will die themselves. And the Buddha tells us that when he was a young man, when he was still a Bodhisattva, he realised, he fully accepted that he would get ill, he would grow old, he would die. And then at that time, when he'd fully accepted this, he said the vanity, the intoxication, the arrogance that comes with health, with youth, and with life itself, entirely left him. So you can see in reflections like this, in such, it's really insight that the Buddha's having, the Buddha, the Bodhisattva, Gotama, removing the barriers between self and other, way before he'd gained enlightenment. So no wonder in another beautiful passage in the Pali Canon, we find the Buddha saying, before my enlightenment, when I was still a Bodhisattva, I reflected, alas, this world has fallen on trouble, has fallen on suffering. Oh, when will an escape from this trouble, from this suffering, be known? It's very interesting. He says, this world. He doesn't say, me. This world. When will an escape be known for the world? And he goes on to describe how he found an escape from trouble and suffering through discovering the truth of the Dhamma, particularly Pratichasamutpada. So it's clear from passages like these that the Buddha, before his enlightenment, was searching for enlightenment, not only for himself, but for the benefit of all beings. And then, of course, after his enlightenment, he has that great vision, which I never tire of talking about, that great vision of all beings as lotus flowers, red and white and blue lotus flowers there, stuck there in the mud. Some are more stuck in the mud than others. Some are pushing forth and beginning to open to the sunshine, but all of them are beautiful. All of them are alive. All of them are growing, but they all need the Dharma. So seeing this, having this vision of all beings in this way, it said that compassion arose in the Buddha, the word for compassion here being anukampa, which means literally to tremble with. So it's as if his full enlightenment is trembling with, resonating with, the potential for enlightenment in all beings. The Buddha's compassion comes from recognizing the Buddha potential in all beings. And his compassionate activity is to draw that potential forth, to enable others to grow, to open fully, to gain enlightenment themselves. So that's the Buddha's compassionate vision of life. And immediately after that great vision, the Buddha just goes forth from the Bodhi tree and its environs and begins to communicate to others. First of all, he teaches the five bhikkhus, as they're called, his old friends in asceticism who'd left him in disgust. He teaches them the Dhamma. He shows them the Dhamma. They were very resistant to him at first, but the Buddha didn't bother about that. He didn't, if you like, pay much attention to their resistances. What he saw was their potential for enlightenment. That's what he connected with. That's what he communicated with. And then a bit later on, after he'd the five bhikkhus had become arhats, had become enlightened, he then converted or brought to the Dhamma or fired off, sparked off in the Dhamma, Yasha, who was a playboy, a wealthy playboy from the city of Benares, who just stumbled on the Buddha in the deer park at Sarnath, stumbled on him in a real state. You know, his life was in complete crisis. He was so disgusted with himself, had apparently no interest in the spiritual life before that. But there he was before the Buddha. So the Buddha communicated with him directly, brought him to enlightenment. And in time, 50 of Yasha's playboy friends came across the Buddha and became enlightened themselves. And the Buddha's teaching, his communication at that time, was so electric, so effective, so vivid, that all of these people became enlightened, became arahants. The five bhikkhus, Yasha and his playboy friends. And, you know, the atmosphere must have been extraordinary. It seems that early Buddhism, the very earliest days of Buddhism, there was just this electricity in the atmosphere around the Buddha, and people were really being sparked off by his communication. And the Buddha called the 60 together and he said, "Bhikkhus, I am free from all shackles, whether human or divine. You are free from all shackles, whether human or divine. Go now and wander for the welfare and happiness of the many. Out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, the welfare, the happiness of gods and men, teach the Dhamma that is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the spirit and the letter. Explain a pure spiritual life. There are beings with little dust on their eyes who will be lost through not hearing the Dhamma. Some will understand the Dhamma." And he didn't just urge his disciples to wander while he sort of sat around, presumably blissing out in enlightenment, because at the end of this exhortation, he says, "I shall go to Aruvala, to Senanyagama, to teach the Dhamma." And apparently staying there were some very, very difficult customers indeed, the naked fire-worshipping ascetics. But that's another story. So the Buddha didn't just urge his disciples to communicate the Dhamma out of compassion. He did it himself for the rest of his days. So it's very clear from passages like this that the aim of the Buddhist path is to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all. Some people sometimes say, "Well, let's only do something for others after we're enlightened. We'll just concentrate on ourselves." But we can't afford to do that. It's very unlikely, in fact, if we do that, that we'll make much progress. We need to start now. We need to start now, not just working on ourselves, but doing what we can to benefit others from our practice. We need to start now on the Bodhisattva path. And that path traditionally begins with what is known as the arising of the bodhicitta, the bodhicitta utpada. the arising within us, if that's the right language here, of a transpersonal, transcendental force impelling us in the direction of wisdom and compassion. And in traditional Mahayana, the arising of the bodhicitta is seen as something sort of higher than and beyond going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. But Bhante sees it, quite rightly in my view, as just another way of describing going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Another way of describing the transition from mundane to transcendental. Another way of describing the act of commitment. And of course the language of going for refuge is really the sort of primary language to describe the act of commitment, because it's the most ancient language that describes commitment to the Buddhist path. But it's also the most practical, because the language of going for refuge itself describes the act of commitment in volitional and existential terms. You go for refuge. You move. You act. You do something. You commit yourself to what is truly reliable, truly worthwhile, the refuges of the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. The language of bodhicitta draws out other aspects of this decisive spiritual act. Principally, it draws out the altruistic dimension of going for refuge. But the language of bodhicitta draws out actually much more than that. And the rest of this talk will be an exploration of the different, of some of the dimensions of bodhicitta. And I'm going to do that by exploring, by considering how we can give rise to the bodhicitta, how we can set up the conditions for the arising of the bodhicitta, what we can do to open up to this transpersonal, transcendental force. And of course, in Bhante's talk, that wonderful talk, The Awakening of the Bodhi Heart, Bhante gives two great methods, great practices that set up the conditions for the arising of the bodhicitta. There's Shantideva's devotional sevenfold puja, and there's Vasubandhu's more intellectual four factors. And I'm not going to talk about either of them, because they're well explored in Bhante's talk. Instead, I'm going to speak of five things. And these five things are the five great stages of the spiritual path that form the framework for all of the spiritual practices in the Tri Ratna Buddhist community and the Tri Ratna Buddhist order. And these five great stages, I mean, you as it were get the whole set when you're ordained, but recently in the Preceptors College we've been saying that we feel that actually these five stages need to be taught right from the beginning of somebody's involvement, as soon as they come to the centre. Not in their full form that they take when you're ordained, but certainly preparing people for the full practice. And I believe that these five great stages and the practices associated with them, if we practice them intensively, we will be opening up to the bodhicitta. And these five great stages were originally taught by Bhante back in 1976 here in a seminar on Nagarjuna's precious garland. The seminar was auspicious in other ways because it was the retreat on which Surita was ordained. His public ordination, by the way, took place in front of the tea counter. It wasn't a tea counter then, it was a shrine. So that's a very, very holy place at Padmaloka. He also followed this up not long after this seminar, Bhante, with a talk on an order convention called A System of Meditation, which is related to these five great stages of the path. He arranges our different practices in a system. And, you know, this is a very, very important set of practices. Like I say, it's the whole framework with which we practice in our movement. So these stages and the practices associated with them are our path. And I hope we'll see how intensive engagement with them can lead to the arising of the bodhicitta. Because all of them, all of these stages, have qualities associated with the bodhicitta. So the five great stages of the path are, first of all, I should just say these five great stages of the path are related to a traditional Buddhist sect called the Five Paths. But I won't refer to the Five Paths, but they do relate back to a traditional sect. But Bhante's sort of put them in a, kind of translated them into a form that we can use now. So the five great stages are, first of all, mindfulness and integration. Secondly, positive emotion. Though some people are saying now that perhaps that should be called skillful intention, but I'll say more about that in a moment. Thirdly, spiritual death. Fourthly, spiritual rebirth. And fifthly, spontaneity or spontaneous compassionate activity. So first of all, mindfulness and integration. So this is the first thing we need when we take up the path. I remember when Bhante talked about this in this lecture on a system of meditation, he describes, you know, as stumbling along to the meditation class, you know, and how sort of divided while we're loosely held together by a name and address, and how we need to take up something like the mindfulness of breathing to gather ourselves, to bring ourselves together. It's very hard to make any progress if our attention and our energies, more importantly, are divided, if we're conflicted. You know, one day we make a bit of progress, you know, that we're going to save the world, we're going to be a wonderful human being. The next day, it's as if we're another person, a completely different person, and we're not with that program at all, with a completely different program. So we really do need to practice mindfulness, and the aim of mindfulness is to make more of a rounded, more of a whole, integrated human being, so that we don't fritter away what we've gained, so that we can move along, you know, fully, completely. So we need to practice mindfulness, which of course means practicing the mindfulness of breathing, and it's simple form, and you know, we can also practice it in a more developed form, as in the stages of the Anapanasati meditation. And of course, there's the importance of mindfulness in daily life. I'm a big enthusiast for Sangharakshita's four dimensions of awareness. I think it's a wonderful set, really underestimated. I think for Westerners, it's actually much better than even, dare one say, the Satipatthana dimensions. So the four dimensions that Bhante speaks of is mindfulness of the environment, things, nature, and so on. So immediately you're positively aware of your environment. Mindfulness of self, which is mindfulness of the body and its movements. Mindfulness of thoughts. Mindfulness of feelings and emotions. And then mindfulness of others. Mindfulness of other people. Really attending to others. And the fourth dimension is mindfulness of reality, which could be a reflection on the Dhamma, it could be recollecting the Buddha, it could even be chanting a mantra. It's a wonderful set, and his lecture on that in the Eightfold Path series is one of his very best. So mindfulness is a very, very rich field of spiritual practice, and one which I think has been quite well explored, not necessarily, at least in theory. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're all wonderfully mindful. However, through mindfulness, we gather ourselves. And when we gather ourselves, we can begin to open up to and become more receptive to higher and deeper spiritual realities. An important aspect of mindfulness is mindfulness of purpose. Mindfulness of our goal, and mindfulness of goal means that you need to have a goal. You need to have a spiritual ideal. If we want, and in fact, if we really want to gather ourselves, if we want to integrate ourselves, we need something that transcends us. We need something that we're connected to that's much, much bigger than ourselves. We need a goal, an ideal, big enough, deep enough, meaningful enough to take all of ourselves, to take everything and more. The word for goal in Sanskrit is arta, which is a very rich, rich word. It doesn't just mean goal, it means the good. It means the truly meaningful. It also has the meaning of auspiciousness. So we need an aim in life, a goal in life, an ideal in life that is majestic, beautiful, fascinating, lovely, which is true for us, which is real for us, which we can connect with, which we can feel connected with, and which draws our energies around. And the bodhicitta, of course, is such a goal. Bodhicitta means mind, it means heart. It's the mind and heart of enlightenment. Bodhicitta is a full and radiant, loving awareness. Someone with bodhicitta has an incredible intensity and depth and breadth of mindfulness. But it's a loving mindfulness. And it's very interesting the way the Mahayana describe the bodhicitta, describing it as they use lots of images to evoke it, to so that we get really fascinated in it. It's the wish-fulfilling jewel, the healing tree. It's like a diamond, like a vajra, and so on. So we need to hold the goal of the bodhicitta in consciousness, in our consciousness. And we need to connect it to all of our activities, even the most mundane of activities. We need to see how does what I'm doing now relate to my overall purpose. We need to connect, if you like, the near, the everyday, to the far. We need to bring them together. Of course, that also means avoiding activities that don't connect us with our goal, that disrupt our connection with the bodhicitta. And we need to intensify activities that connect us with the bodhicitta. Shantideva in the Bodhicharyavatara, which is a wonderful manual on the bodhisattva's life and is full of incredible insights into the bodhicitta, has a whole chapter on mindfulness. It's called Samprajanya Rakshana, which can be translated as guarding mindfulness or even guarding one's purpose. Guarding one's comprehension of the goal. And there are beautiful descriptions of how to practice moment by moment if you're serious about the bodhicitta. Some of it is related to very basic aspects of mindfulness. For example, he talks about how a real son of the Buddha, a real bodhisattva, somebody really serious about developing the bodhicitta, needs to move around very, very silently, really silently. He says you should be like a crane in a pond, moving so slowly that it doesn't disturb the fish. Or that you should move as silently and as carefully as a cat, or even a thief. I think this is a really good practice when you're leaving the shrine room. Perhaps when we're coming in as well, but particularly when we're leaving, you know, when people are deep in meditation, you know, you sometimes know who's had a good sit and who hasn't, because, you know, you get the, you think, oh, that one, he didn't do too well, did he? And of course, if you don't notice somebody going out, you know they've had a really good sit. So when we're training in the bodhicitta, we don't make waves. We move smoothly through life, fully aware. Shantideva even looks at things like, well, if you're practicing mindfulness, you don't knock things over. You don't crash into things. That all seems terribly basic, but really he's talking about living a harmless life. A harmless life. He speaks as well of recollecting the Buddhas as a way of practicing mindfulness. Acting as if you were in the presence of the Buddhas or in the presence of the Buddha. He points out that people, how mindful people are when they're with their teacher or their preceptor. I don't know about other preceptors, but certainly when Bhante's around, the mindfulness level goes right up. It's really interesting. You know, we can all be sort of, you know, like, you know, making a lot of noise. When Bhante comes into a room, suddenly you just become mindful. And it's not because you're frightened of censure or anything like that. It's just because he's very mindful. And the mindfulness sort of just exudes from him. So it's very interesting. It's great when Bhante's around because people are much more attentive and much more careful about what they say and what they do. Well, I certainly am anyway. But Shantideva says, well, we can't be with our teacher all the time. So recollect the Buddhas, recollect the Bodhisattvas, so that you can keep your mind on your purpose, which is the bodhicitta. You can recollect what you're really about. And Shantideva includes in mindfulness, in the practice of mindfulness, mindfulness of others and how you speak to them. It's a very, very beautiful passage. One should speak confident, measured words, clear in meaning, delighting the mind, pleasing to the ear, soft and slow, and stemming from compassion. One should always look at people directly, as if drinking them in with the eye, thinking it's because of them that enlightenment can be attained. And this is a very beautiful point that Shantideva's making, because there's no enlightenment without compassion, and there's no compassion without beings to have compassion for. So whoever you're with, feel grateful, feel pleased, because they're giving you the opportunity to develop love and compassion, which is absolutely crucial to your spiritual development. But I love this phrase he's used, really drinking people in, taking them in. It's a beautiful phrase, and really looking directly and speaking, you know, with real awareness of them and real awareness of compassion. Beautiful. So I think from these few things, I'm sure there's a lot more we can say here, I think you can see how the practice of mindfulness can open us up to the bodhicitta. Through mindfulness, we gather ourselves around the bodhicitta, and we bring awareness of the bodhicitta into every aspect of our lives and into all our relationships. So the second great stage of the spiritual path is called positive emotion. As with mindfulness, positive emotion is indispensable to spiritual life. Positive emotion, it's one of those phrases that I think, you know, can be terribly misunderstood. It doesn't mean going around with an inane, false grin on your face, being positive in an insincere and thoroughly irritating manner. Positive emotion means setting our mind in a skillful and creative direction. It means especially making the effort to develop, to cultivate the Brahma-viharas, the divine abodes of love, that's metta, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Positive emotion, this stage, means developing faith, devotion, and reverence. All these emotions represent the most positive, skillful, creative ways of responding to others in different states. Metta is really the sort of fundamental, if you almost the basic positive emotion, if you like, the fundamental response. Metta really is friendliness. Friendliness to everyone we meet, everyone we think of, everyone we encounter. So we need to train in metta bhavana, aiming to abide in metta all the time. And when we come across suffering in others, if we have metta, compassion springs up. Compassion is the activity of alleviating suffering. When we come across the happiness of others, we feel gladness, mudita. We're glad, we're joyful at the happiness of others. And equanimity is an emotion very hard to describe, actually, and very easy to misunderstand. I think of it as a sort of loving serenity. a kind of loving peace, even, where we're unmoved by the ever-changing flow, or, if you like, the ups and downs of living beings. There's just a serene and constant loving kindness because, you know, we're more in tune with the way things are. Reverence, faith, and devotion arises when our friendliness encounters someone or something higher than ourselves. Our love, as it were, naturally flows upwards. So these are the basic positive emotions that we're developing. And of course, they have all sorts of subtle shades and hues. You know, it's not just these emotions. There's a whole range of positive, skillful, creative emotions that we'll experience as we practice. And we really do need to develop such emotions because it's our emotions that move us and drive us in life. Our emotions are so bound up with our volition, our will. We are creatures of desire, after all. So our desires need to be positively engaged in our movement towards the bodhicitta. And this is really what the development of positive emotion is all about. It's all about the transformation of our desires, the transformation of our will, bringing that more in line with the bodhicitta. And of course, the bodhicitta itself is described as the great loving heart, the great compassionate heart. The bodhicitta is the mind, the heart of boundless loving kindness and compassion. It's a measureless heart, a measureless mind, a mind of no boundaries. There's no boundaries to the love and compassion, and indeed the sympathetic joy and equanimity of the bodhicitta. In early Mahayana, they say simply that the bodhicitta are these four Brahma-viharas, these four boundless states. And the Buddha describes in the Pali Canon in many places what the mind of loving kindness is really like, what we're really doing in Metta-bhavana. He says this of the other Brahma-viharas, but I'll just read what he says about Metta, about loving kindness. A bhikkhu dwells, pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise, the second quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth quarter. Thus, above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, he dwells, pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility, without ill will. This is called the measureless liberation of mind. Very, very beautiful passage. That's what we're aiming to achieve in the Metta-bhavana. And when you read descriptions like this, it's clear that even in the earliest scriptures, that the aim of the Metta-bhavana is really to open up to a loving kindness that really transcends self and other. If you talk about boundlessness and measurelessness, that means there really isn't a self involved. I mean, they mean that literally. Your self has sort of vanished into this measureless, boundless love. Bhante himself has said that the aim of Metta is to experience a sort of free-floating loving-kindness. It's not your loving-kindness. It's not others' loving-kindness. And when you speak like this, when you use this sort of language, it means that you're moving into the territory of the bodhicitta. Because, of course, the bodhicitta is a selfless, egoless force of loving-kindness and compassion. But note, too, in that quotation that I read, and to all as to himself. And to all as to himself. Which gives us a wonderful clue to the development of metta, which people often find so difficult. And the paradox is, the seeming paradox is that the key to selfless love, to boundless love, is in fact ourselves, our bounded selves. Throughout Buddhist tradition, in the Pali texts, and you find this worked out very, very thoroughly in the meditation section of the Bodhicharavatara, we're instructed to reflect on our basic desires, in the sense that we want to be well, we want to be happy, we want to be protected, we want to feel okay, we want to be safe from harm, we want to be without fear. We want all those things, of course we do. It doesn't, you know, forget about the different ways that we try and go about it, but that is, those are our basic motivations. We want to be okay, we want to be happy, we want to be well. Every other living being is exactly the same as us in this respect. They are exactly the same. They want exactly those same things. Forget about the weird and wonderful ways they're going about it. That is actually what they want. We don't need to know any other information about another human being, another living being, than that. That they have the same basic desires as we do. They want to be happy, they don't want to suffer. Others want to be well, they want to be treated well. They want happiness, they want fulfillment. So why not give them that? Why not wish them that, if that's what they want? Shantideva says, you know, what's so special about me that I just want my own happiness and I ignore the happiness of others? So we do all that we can to give our attention to others, because they're just the same as ourselves. Why cut ourselves off from others and just take care of ourselves? Why not identify, imaginatively identify, with everybody and everything? Why not tremble with others and generate the great loving heart, the boundless, selfless heart of Maitri, of Metta? And of course, you know, when we're practicing like this, we're opening up to bodhicitta. And talking about selflessness brings us to the next great stage of the spiritual path, which Sangharakshita calls spiritual death. So a pause for a drink at this stage. Nothing stronger than water. So the stage of spiritual death comes about through seeing things as they really are. Yatabhuta gnana darshana. Seeing knowledge and vision of things as they really are. And the stage of spiritual death comes about through reflection on, contemplation of the great truths of impermanence, suffering, insubstantiality, and so on. The great truths of the Dhamma, the great marks of existence. Through the practice of mindfulness, through generating positive emotion, we will develop quite a substantial, together, positive human being. But that's not enough. As Bhante said, you know, that you can attain that through these stages. And that's very good, but you can lose it. You know, and you can even think you've sort of arrived somewhere, but you can lose it. It's one of the things you notice. I've noticed over the years, people getting involved in the Dharma, they come along in a bit of a state. The Dharma helps them put themselves together, and then they disappear. You know, they're really into it, but in a way, they've just arrived at a sort of oasis, if you like. But there's much, much further to go. Heaven is not the end. Even a positive, good human life is not the end. It's not enough. In one way or another, at a deep and subtle level, we possess a fixed view of ourselves. It might be quite a positive view of ourselves. It might be quite a positive view of other people. It's as good as far as it goes, but it's a view. And it's a false view, and it closes us off from the vital and radiant reality around us. It blocks the bodhicitta, you could say. Now within the order, the main practice we employ to undo this false view of a fixed and separate self is the contemplation of the six elements. I'll just give you a little glimpse of what we do in the first stage of this practice. We reflect on the element earth, on all solid things, so wood and soil and stone and rock and so on, the earth element outside, and then we reflect on the earth element inside the solid elements, hair and skin and teeth and flesh and bone and fat and all the vital organs and so on. And then we reflect that, well, actually, we haven't made and we don't own this solid element within ourselves. We've actually borrow it from the earth outside. Each day we take in so much food, it goes back as feces, things drop off, skin drops off, hair falls out, and so on. There's this sort of process of coming and going of the earth element, and in fact, the earth in the end in us will be completely taken from us, because all the solid elements in our body will turn to dust, to ashes, to earth. We'll just go back to the earth element. So what we're doing with this reflection is that we're freeing our mind from a view, that a self-view that is bound up with our solidity. And it's quite a practice. Actually, it can be a very, very relaxing practice. It's actually a relief to open up to this reality, that we actually don't possess ourselves. You know, we think we're in charge, but when you actually analyse the situation, we really aren't. And it's good to wise up to that. So it can be a very, very relieving sort of practice. Now, you don't have to wait for ordination to start contemplating the way things are. You can start right now. I don't mean by taking on the full or even the partial six element practice, but of course, I'm sure you do this. You can reflect on, well, on impermanence. You know, insight practice can be very, very simple, reflecting on the impermanence all around us. And of course the impermanence inside us, on our ageing and the actual fact of death, the inevitability of death, and the fact that death can come at any time, at any moment. So we can reflect on these things, and in the face of that truth of impermanence and death, the question inevitably comes: how will I live? How will I live in relation to this fact of impermanence and death? What will I do? Will I just live in denial of that truth? Eat, drink and be merry, or whatever it might be. Will I just waste time? Or will I instead live with real meaning if death is certain? If it can come at any time, at any moment, what is the most meaningful, the most creative way I can actually live? So these are the sort of questions that we can begin to ask ourselves. And actually, contemplation of actual death, if you've done the necessary preparation, positive preparation, and it's important to do that, that does start to lead to spiritual death. Because when you look death in the eye from a positive basis, negative emotion, the kleshas, as they're called, and delusion begin to drop away. Negative habits begin to drop away. It might not be some dramatic, cataclysmic breakthrough, but you just notice that certain things just start dropping away. You know, the message is going in, not to waste time. And it can be liberating. You can have this feeling of liberation. Sometimes, it has to be said, it can be frightening when you start contemplating death. When you actually start having some experience of spiritual death, those negative habits start to drop away. You start to see the incredible freedom opening up. But we're so identified with our negative, restricted habits, it's frightening. The sheer reality is frightening. Or at least very, very stirring. So the bodhicitta has this quality too. This quality of reality, of a sort of naked reality, because the bodhicitta is completely egoless. Classical descriptions of the bodhicitta insist that as well as being the great loving heart and so on, and as well as being like a wish-fulfilling jewel and all the rest of it, the bodhicitta is also shunya. It's empty and it's anatman. It's without any fixed self nature. It is empty and insubstantial. It's not a self. The bodhicitta is completely open. It's deeper than any ocean. It's vaster than any sky. And it's of immense transcendental power. That's a very strange way to talk, and it can be misunderstood. But Shantideva, following general Mahayana tradition, describes the bodhicitta, the reality of the bodhicitta, as being like the great blazing fire, the great inferno that, according to Indian Buddhist cosmology, consumes the cosmos at the end of every eon. Apparently, the whole cosmos just goes up in a massive, all-consuming conflagration. Well, Shantideva says that the bodhicitta is like that. When you're in contact with it, it consumes. What it consumes is, in an instant, is all of our evil, all of our unskillful tendencies deriving from ignorance, all our potentiality for evil, which would emerge given the right conditions. And sometimes we can sense the heat of the bodhicitta, and it seems to be consuming us completely, or it seems to want to consume us completely. We seem to be dying to the bodhicitta. But in Buddhist tradition, after every death, there is rebirth, of course. After every winter, there is spring. There is renewal. And so the next great stage of the path is the stage of spiritual rebirth. We might spiritually die, but a new being will re-emerge, a being fully in accordance with the bodhicitta. And in our order, the spiritual practice that aims to bring about spiritual rebirth is meditation on a Buddha or a bodhisattva that you're given at the time of your private ordination. And what we're doing in this kind of practice is contemplating, imagining, opening up to an embodiment of bodhicitta that most attracts us, that most appeals to us, that we have a deep response to. What we're doing here really is meditating on the Buddha, or if you like, the mind of the Buddha, the bodhicitta, the enlightened mind. And all these forms and expression, all these forms are expressions of the Buddha's enlightenment. They're all aspects of bodhicitta. All these images in here are depictions, pictures of qualities of the Buddha's enlightenment. Subhuti was saying to me recently that when we're in the shrine room here, we should feel that we're actually inhabiting the Buddha's mind. That's what all these images are trying to convey. So again, we can begin to do that, not just waiting for ordination, but we can begin imagining now. I know some people already have strong responses to particular Buddha forms, bodhisattva forms, that are very, very meaningful to them. But sometimes not everybody has those responses, and you can begin to ask yourself, what does the Buddha look like to me? What does the bodhicitta look like? What image does it take? What form does it assume? What mood does it bring? What sound does it have? So try to feel, try to sense, try to see what comes, try to open up to the bodhicitta. You know, sometimes you might try doing this at the end of your mindfulness of breathing or your metta bhavana. Try to sit and just sort of open up to, you know, how does the Buddha come? How does the bodhicitta come? Bhante not only calls this stage the stage of spiritual rebirth, he also speaks of it as being the stage of transformation. When you talk about transformation, that sort of evoking, if you like, constant death and rebirth. Spiritual death and spiritual rebirth don't happen in one cataclysmic event. It might sort of seem like that sometimes, but really they happen again and again and yet again. And the more intensively we engage in the spiritual life, in all the practices I've mentioned, the more the transformations come. I lost a page. No, I haven't. Sorry about that. I lost my thread. Of course, as well as practicing these stages, we also need to practice them in the context of spiritual friendship and spiritual community. That's right, and this is related to this topic of transformation. You'll see the connection in a minute. Bhante has said that he regards the bodhicitta as more likely to arise within a spiritual community rather than in an isolated individual. And what he means by a spiritual community is, you know, a community of fully committed individuals, committed to the path, committed to the kind of path that I've already described, who are in vital and intense and deep interaction with one another and communication with one another, and who are united by a common purpose, particularly of spreading the Dhamma. When you're in a community like that, then you start to experience real transformation, both individual and collective, as it were. And you can start to get glimpses of the bodhicitta arising and pervading. You can see how the bodhicitta can arise and pervade and inspire the whole community. If you like, the deep purpose of the community, working, enabling the community to work together for the benefit of all. So practicing the stages of the path within the context of spiritual community is like being in the alembic of the alchemist, the cauldron of the alchemist. You know, the alchemist transmutes base metal into gold. Well, Shantideva speaks of the bodhicitta like this. He likens the bodhicitta to the special magical quicksilver elixir of the alchemist that transforms the base metal into gold. So Shantideva speaks of the great transforming power of the bodhicitta in these words. The bodhicitta takes hold of this base image, our ordinary human form, and transmutes it into the priceless form of the Buddha Gem. Grasp tightly the quicksilver elixir, the bodhicitta, which must be thoroughly worked into our being. So practicing the stages of the path within a spiritual community, we're thoroughly working the bodhicitta into ourselves and into each other, if you like. And then there will be transformation. Then there will be the arising of the bodhicitta. And then what? Well, then what begins to open up is the fifth and final stage of the path. Bhante calls this spontaneity or spontaneous compassionate activity. By spontaneity, he doesn't mean being impulsive or reactive. Spontaneity can here mean, on a sort of, if you like, quite basic level for us, the important aspect of letting go, of being receptive in our practice, of having a dimension where we're opening up. The practice here, of course, is the just sitting that we do at the end of all practices which involve effort and development, at the end of every mindfulness of breathing, every metta bhavana, every contemplation of death and impermanence, at the end of every recollection of the Buddha, at the end of every puja, we should just sit for a little while and just open up. Just open up to what may or may not come. There's that wonderful experience we can have at the end of the puja after going through the seven stages and then the mantras. Then sometimes you get a real sense of what just sitting really is. You're just, you know, opening up to the sort of vibrations that are kind of around, and what's there to say? You let whatever come through. It also, I think, just sitting means doing nothing in the day. Sitting in a chair, doing nothing. Surita, I don't know if he still does this, but he used to be a great practitioner, non-practitioner, of what he called the garden practice. He had a period of just going and sitting in a chair, finding a quiet corner in the garden, and just sit for 20 minutes, just looking at the garden, doing nothing. Just doing nothing. And it was a really important practice for him, as important as all the effort. So yes, we need that dimension, the doing nothing dimension. I was talking in the group this morning about the really important teaching of Bhante's, of which is very strongly related to the Bodhisattva path, of the greater mandala of uselessness, the greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation, which the Bodhisattva operates in. Yes, he's also in the smaller mandala of utility, making things happen, getting things done. But there's a whole dimension he's drawing on of complete, well, it's that boundlessness, that openness. Also, spontaneous so there's spontaneity in that sense of being receptive. But he also speaks of this last stage of the path as being the stage of spontaneous compassionate activity. That's the aim of the Bodhisattva path. It's fantastic, isn't it? The aim is lila, is play. Playfully, really being in touch with the flow of energy that benefits others. And actually you see this quality in the life of the Buddha. They don't use the language of lila in the Pali text. In a way, they're far too sober for that. But you know, check it out. I mean, when you look at the Buddha's life, the way he wanders, the way he communicates, the way he teaches, through illness, in the face of death, he does it, I'm sure he doesn't even use this language, but he does it because that's what he does. Because he loves to do it. He loves to benefit others. But he's not thinking, I am benefiting others. It's not like that. He's removed all self-consciousness in that sense. It's completely natural. So even though there's, you know, what looks like to others, toil and work for the benefit of others, it's not like that for him. He's fully aligned with bodhicitta, with the mind of wisdom and compassion. So it's natural, it's spontaneous, it's sahaja, as the tantrics call it. It's lila, it's play, it's lalita. It's what the Mahayana calls anubhogacharya, the coursing in supreme enjoyment. So that's the goal, that's what we're aiming for through all this practice, all this intensive engagement. I mean, it's very, very important to open up to that dimension, but don't pretend. You do get pseudo lila vardins who, you know, think they've arrived and they haven't, and they're terribly deluded. But anyway, that's another story. Needless to say, but I'm going to say it, such a path that we're committing to, the Bodhisattva path, the great stages of the path, requires commitment, tremendous commitment, resolve. We need to really give ourselves to this path. And in fact, the Bodhisattva tradition stresses the importance of commitment, resolve, vow, again and again. And they stress the importance of committing and recommitting, re-resolving to follow this path, vowing to follow this path. So I'll end with very famous words from Shantideva from the Bodhicharya Charyavatara, describing at least one aspect of what it's like to for the bodhicitta to arise, to be reborn through the bodhicitta. As the Buddhas of ancient times grasped this bodhicitta and followed resolutely upon the bodhisattva path, so shall I awaken this precious bodhicitta for the welfare of the world, and I too shall follow that path in all its fullness. And like a wise man who joyfully seizes that bodhicitta, I shall rejoice so that it will grow and thrive in me. Today my birth has borne fruit, and my humanity has been fulfilled. Today I am reborn into the Buddha family, and I am now a son of the Buddha. And now I must live up to my birth, and by my actions must place no stain upon that spotless family.